You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 U.S.-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out Pear.com today to learn more. That's P-A-I-R.com.
This is Joshua Karayevsky. You are listening to the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I am your host for the evening, Jay Hursko, and joining me is fellow board member Paul Ilya. Paul, thank you for joining us.
Jay, I just love that you continue the tradition of mispronunciations. I'm Ilya, but that's cool.
Ilya. Okay, so I missed the accent on the second syllable.
No, that's good. No, so tell our listeners who we're talking about tonight. Whose work are we talking about tonight?
So tonight is the third episode in our Modern Agile series, and we're going to be discussing the principle of make safety a prerequisite. Paul and I are both very passionate about this. We have some good experiences in our past and some good ideas. So let's begin. So I think the best way to start this off would be by discussing what the actual idea states. So from Josh Karayevsky's modernagile.org site, make safety a prerequisite. And the quote is, "Safety is both a basic human need and a key to unlocking high performance. We actively make safety a prerequisite by establishing safety before engaging in any hazardous work. We protect people's time, information, reputation, money, health, and relationships. And we endeavor to make our collaborations, products, and services resilient and safe." It says a lot right there, but I think it's very, very well put and encapsulates the heart of what he's trying to do. So let me ask you this, Paul. When we look at this principle, what does this really mean to you?
Well, I like that he's got such a list here, because safety, I think when people hear make safety a prerequisite and they don't read the whole paragraph, like it's what is it? Four sentences?
Yeah.
There's a lot in here. It depends on where you need safety, I think, is where you hear it first. But there's a lot in here. So did you hear psychological safety, workplace, like, you know, not letting people make mistakes? Did you hear physical safety, OSHA violation type safety? What kind of safety did you hear, right?
Right. And to that point, Paul, you just made a brilliant observation. Is you said where you need it is where you hear it. And I think you're absolutely right. If you don't read the whole paragraph, you may think safety, and depending upon your preconceived notion, depending upon your experience, your current role, your current program, you may think of safety as one thing when the statement, the central tenet is way more encapsulating than that. It's much bigger than just safety in just one facet.
Right. So before the show, we did some research, right? And I think we could maybe each share a little bit of some of the research. And just digging into Joshua's blog from mid-early 2010 period, he talks about safety becoming an obsession of his in about 2012 timeframe, reading about the Alcoa turnaround, the aluminum company. But he gives examples like, so here's one. I love this one. This is the Golden Gate safety example that he gave. This is from a blog post, January 2015. And he's talking about building the Golden Gate Bridge in the 1930s. And the leadership put $130,000 investment in. And you think about what that could possibly, I don't even know what that equates to now. Is that a gajillion dollars now? Right?
It's got to be something huge, yeah.
Something huge, because we went crazy and got off the gold standard. You know, don't get me on my soapbox. But
and then also, correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, this was built during the Depression.
Absolutely.
So $130,000 is, even at that time, was a huge sum.
And so somebody thought the bridge was a good idea, and putting $130,000 investment into safety, like hard hats, nets, all the things that we have come to believe in physical construction are prerequisites, right? And there's a quote in his blog post. It says, look, the loss of life, the delays that would occur from men working slower because they had to be a bit more careful so they wouldn't fall, probably made the $130,000 a very economic innovation, right?
Which is very true. I mean, imagine, I know when I'm doing something, when I'm up on a ladder, when I'm cleaning my gutters, when I'm trimming the willow tree that's next to my house, which some listeners are going to say, you shouldn't have a willow tree next to your house because the roots are shallow. But I move exponentially slower than I would if I was on the ground trimming a hedge or cleaning out one of the drain spigots, because I'm much more concerned about my safety. If I was tethered to the chimney, which, let's be honest here, judging by my weight, I might actually take the chimney off. But I probably would move a little quicker because I have that in the back of my mind that I know there's an element of safety there.
Right. So take it. So I love the physical example from the Golden Gate Bridge. And I love that Joshua got his inspiration from this Alcoa story, but he's applying it all over the place when he's talking about it. And you know that we have these experiences at work where people are afraid of getting fired for making a mistake, getting ridiculed, getting yelled at, right?
Right. Yeah.
So it doesn't always have to be physical. It doesn't always have to be psychological. I give you another example. Going through this right now at work, where we're putting policy statements together for some public cloud work. And, you know, it's pretty important stuff. The impact of mistakes could be huge. So that weighs on people's heads, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we're putting together policy documents, right? And we're having a challenge, and we've got the right people on the ground to have these conversations and to tease this stuff out. But the old way of doing things, of a policy document, like you should handle application security this way, X, Y, and Z, doesn't cut it in the public cloud.
Right.
You actually have to automate that policy. It has to be impossible to violate it. It's the only way to go, right? So that's safety, so that the people that have access to the public cloud services that are just providing our customers with what they need have automated that safety.
Right.
So that the application developers can't shoot themselves in the foot. And I'm, you know, hope that didn't come off wrong, but it can't be a policy document that you guys should do this, but not that. It has to be impossible to do it only, but the right thing.
So You made an interesting point. This is a little bit of a digression, but I think it still holds water. You talked about fear and people not doing certain things or doing certain things because they're afraid of the ramifications, afraid of what happens, failure, ridicule, termination. Fear is a great motivator if you want things done, but not a great motivator if you want quality delivered. Because when someone is fearful, they're not really thinking. They're basing everything against what if, what if, what if. What can I do to make sure that what I'm afraid of doesn't happen,
right?
Which not necessarily is the right thing to do.
Right.
You talk of, you know, in our worlds, the software developers, they will do things because they're afraid of getting called to bug court, getting dinged because they have too many defects. And fear is actually a horrendous motivator, because all it does is causes your lizard brain to kick in and override things that your actual cognitive brain would actually catch.
Right. Right. You and I both happen to be from the software world. Joshua was very careful to say, this is about beyond software, but that's also my wheelhouse as well. Somebody at Agile 2016 gave a talk, and we might find it and put it in the show notes, but a study was done where if you are in fear of like your job or your livelihood, you've lost 50% of your capacity to participate in the conversations and to do your job. Your brain is in survival mode.
I'm surprised that you lost only 50%, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've been in scenarios where I thought I was on the way out the door with the axe, and you can almost barely function.
Right. Right. And I'm taking an extreme example of fear of job, but that what you just said triggered that. If you just take it to the mild case of, I just don't want to get yelled at, I just don't want to make, you know, look like the dumb one in the room. You know, what's that taking away from your ability to contribute?
It's the when the fear kicks in, the lizard brain takes over. And right. If you've ever read Malcolm Gladwell's Blink or any of that stuff, I think Seth Godin has a book along the same lines. They talk about how when you're not thinking and your fight or flight survival, there's survival mode, fight or flight kicks in. It can actually be seriously detrimental, because you're not rational. You're going off instinct, and your instincts could be wrong. I recently took over a team where I became the scrum master. They had someone who was scrum master in a team. However, this poor guy was doing the best job he could. He had many, many hats. He was trying to do multiple things at once, and it really wasn't working out. He wasn't doing anyone any favors by trying to wear three hats simultaneously. So I volunteered to take over this team. And one of the first things I established with them is, it's okay if something does not go well, as long as we don't do it again and again and again. And the best example, we went into one of our early sprint planning sessions, and I started walking through the backlog and helping them figure out, okay, how are we gonna prioritize this? Because we don't have a real product owner. We're using a systems analyst to be a product owner because we're doing system-to-system integration. That's a whole story for another podcast. But the point I kept trying to make is, let's pick out the stories that we want to commit to, and then let's do our damnedest to deliver them. And the one developer turned to me and said, well, what if we don't deliver? And I said, well, what if you don't deliver? Why would you not deliver? And his response was, well, maybe we picked up too much work. I said, well, there you go. That's a lesson. So it was, we're using safety to experiment. And if we learn that we thought we could do 25 points, but we can only do 18, okay, well, that's something. It's a problem if we continuously commit to 25 and we continuously deliver 18. Right. It's not a problem if we continuously commit to 18, but then we deliver that 18 and eventually we do 19 and right. 20 and 22. And there was a lot of discussions about, well, what if I don't have time to do the design doc? Okay, you don't have time to do the design doc. How can we make the design doc lighter? Well, what if I get yelled at? Well, if you get yelled at, bring your boss to me and let's talk about it. Let's discuss this. Let's come to a good conclusion. And once I sort of, not to give myself credit, the team did a phenomenal job. They really came together and gelled. But once I beat it into their heads that it was okay to try stuff and not succeed as long as we don't try the same stupid thing over and over again, like the Einstein quote, the team turned a corner and they've increased their velocity by, I'd say almost, I think it was 150%, and they're really churning. And I think a lot of that came with them being comfortable with the chance that, you know what, if we try it and it doesn't go wrong, I'm not going to get dinged. I'm not going to get yelled at. I'm not going to be read the riot act by some development manager. We helped create the environment that we could experiment, and it's okay for what happens, and nobody's going to get in trouble. And it bore fruit fairly quickly, I would say, all things considered. That's the most recent example, and that's why I was so excited to get on this podcast, because that's an example of, we took a team that didn't have a lot of Agile experience. We introduced the ability to be safe and try things and learn what we can really do, and now they're blowing by any expectation that anyone had of them. And it's really, really sort of neat to see.
That's cool. That's cool. I love that you use the expression, once I beat it into them, because you and I have a lot in common there. And that's one of the things I struggle with personally in the whole make safety a prerequisite universe, is I've got certain buttons that make me beat things into people, right? And but I think I do it from the place of I'm actually trying to create safety, but look out for those who are in the way of me doing that. So example of, you know, whenever I see a software engineer being treated like as a second class citizen, not a software engineer necessarily, just an engineer, technical person, it's a hot button for me, right? That's one of my key hot buttons. Another one is it's not my job.
Oh, I hate that.
I don't do well with that, right? And so, so when I see that, I kind of clobber the people who are either treating the engineer as a second class citizen, like, sorry, we're the business, we have all the money, we have the budget, you guys are just expenses, or it's not my job. Then I kind of go into, I don't know, something takes over. And I know that that's not exactly what Kieriewski had in mind with Modern Agile and make safety a prerequisite. But I do it from the place of protecting my group.
Right, right. Because you are trying to provide safety for them. And if you have to go about it in sort of an aggressive way to aggressively provide safety, that's your, like you said, we have a lot in common personality wise. We realized this early on. So I would never disagree and say it's the wrong way to go, because if you're being true to yourself and you're true to the team and the organization, and they can see that it's your passion coming out and you're not coming from a place of aggression or from a manager, you know, what gets measured gets managed, what gets managed gets delivered, what gets delivered gets us a bonus, but you're actually trying to help them grow. I really think that's important. And when people see that, it's like a light switch, and the engagement changes, the conversation changes. I don't want to forget the remark you made about treating a developer like a second-class citizen, because I hate that. I hate that when that's done to any employee. I've actually worked at a place where contractors outnumbered the full-time employees by a ratio of 4-1, yet all the contractors were treated like rented mules. And it was not a good – it wasn't a good environment,
right?
And there was no safety. And, you know, we talked about making people awesome. Or wasn't any of that either. And it was a very strenuous place to work. Now, a lot of us took solace in the fact that we were all in the same trench, but still, that's not a way to create longevity in your organization.
Right. Well, and you know, I oftentimes I equate agile coaching, DevOps coaching. I mean, eventually we're going to stop with the buzzwords, but I think coaching, that word sticks around. I always think about sports coaches, and I'm not a huge sports fan. I'm more of a baseball fan than anything else, but no matter what the sport, I don't see a lot of coaches that don't get red in the face and yell, you know?
Right, right.
Right. But yet they can be described as great coaches. Right. So, yeah. So
there's a difference between abuse and passion, and it's, you need to understand where that person's coming from. And some coaches are just abusive, and some coaches are yelling and bright-faced and red because they're passionate.
You know, that reminds me of a personal example from today. Somebody put into the room, hey, are you just, and it wasn't me, but it was somebody else speaking. The person put in the room, hey, are you just being passionate about something here? Or are you upset? Because we were on the phone. It was a valid question. It was a great question. And I liked that somebody stood up in the meeting and spoke that into the meeting, because I think there were probably more people wondering the same thing. And it was just passion. I know the person who was speaking and know exactly where he was coming from. But the safety to be able to speak up like that is cool. You got to foster that as leaders.
Right. And you actually had a point when I was looking at the agenda where you talked about your exact quote is blameless postmortems.
Well, that's an expression in the DevOps universe. It's not unique to DevOps. We were talking about that, I think, before the DevOps term was coined. I want to say DevOps term is 2008, 2009, maybe at the earliest. some of the unicorn companies we try to emulate in the DevOps universe, they celebrate. An employee day one on the job is usually tasked with releasing something to production. That's, I mean, if you're a mature company, you want to do that to your new hires early on. You want to make sure two things. One is they've got what it takes to actually produce like that, right? And the other thing is that your system is resilient enough to handle a newbie making a mistake. Again, safety a prerequisite. It needs to be built into the system that it's cool. There's nothing you can really do that's going to harm us that bad. We can roll back. We can recover. We're not releasing to everybody in the world right away, right? You build these things in.
Paul, isn't there some anecdote from Google where they had a developer push a code in, push a piece of code in, which cost them millions of dollars, and the guy thought he was going to get fired? And I know if one of the listeners can Google that and come up with the exact article, the developer was paranoid that he was going to get fired because he pushed a code in, and it was a change in AdWords, and it cost them millions of dollars. And when they did the retrospective or postmortem, and they looked at it, the ranking executive who owned that piece of AdWords, I guess, or whomever it was, said, did we get more than X amount of dollars of learning from this mistake? And the response, I think, was, well, yeah, now we know that we need to look for A, B, and C. We need to check X, Y, and Z before we go to prod. We're going to change this process. We're going to change this. We're going to change that. And the executive said, well, then, okay, then this money was well spent because we it made ourselves more resilient by learning from our failure. That's a safe environment.
That's good leadership, right? Right.
It's not only great leadership, it's a safe environment. They made a mistake, learned from it, and they made positive change because of it.
Well, that's the way you have to do postmortems. You can't be going, well, you know, Johnny's the one that's supposed to be doing X, Y, and Z. You don't get where you need to go from that. So good. Yeah, I mean, I don't know the exact example. I think there are more, just there's more than that one example out there. That's part of a high maturity environment.
Right, right. When you talk about blameless postmortems, I personally feel that the most important ceremony in any type of agile organization is the retrospective. I truly do. And it's like when you have an addiction problem, a substance abuse problem, problems in your marriage, problems with anything. You need to sit down and honestly appraise where you are sitting in order to make a positive change. The first step in fixing any problem or issue is to admit that you have one. And I think that open honesty and safety inside of a retrospective is paramount to any team's success. I just facilitated a retrospective between the company I'm currently working at and our third-party vendor, who's almost our partner. I would say actually is our partner when it comes to delivering this piece of this piece of software. And there was some real heated, constructive, almost conflict, constructive conflict in the meeting. And the one attendee actually said, I hope you don't think I'm getting angry. I'm just getting very, to your point earlier, I'm getting passionate about this because I'm frustrated because I think we can do better if we just address this one thing. And I thought that was amazing. First of all, it takes chutzpah to say that. And I think we created the environment where that was okay to say something like that. But I talked to people after the session, and this person obviously was over the phone. They weren't in the office. And a couple people after the session actually said to me, you know what? She was right. And we do need to look at that. And she was every right to get frustrated because we've been talking about this one issue. And since day one of the program, sometimes we make progress, sometimes we fall backwards. So maybe we do need to look at fixing it for the better permanently. And I thought that was great because it was an honest opinion. It was coming from a place of caring, and we made the environment safe to air that sort of thing out and not have to worry about ramifications or retribution. Now, if we fix it, well, that's a whole other story entirely. I'll let you know. Yeah. The follow-on episode.
No, these are challenges. But, you know, what I want to say, I want to interject into the conversation is don't expect all this safety to come from leadership either. Like, we're all leaders. I don't care who you are, where you are in the organization. You can move the needle, right?
Right.
You can, and again, we can go back and look at all the pieces of the principle. Where can you make the place less, how can you make the place less hazardous? I mean, this is stupid stuff. I see paper towels loose in the break room. I pick them up, put them in the trash. Right?
Right.
So somebody doesn't slip on them. Anybody can do that. I don't have to be a leader to do that, right? And it's something stupid and silly and simple I just came up with off the top of my head. But you look at all these pieces and you can do something to increase safety in your environment. Don't wait for somebody to set that stage for you.
The corollary I can tie to that is, I don't know if you've read, Seth Godin did a book called Lynchpin, where he talks about how to make yourself indispensable at work. And brilliant, brilliant book. And one of the things he talks about is, there are people inside of companies who always put the square peg in the square hole. And that's how companies survive, because they have people that put the square peg in the round hole, in the square hole. When that same person gets to the round peg, they don't know what to do and they stop. They look for help. They look for instruction. A linchpin, someone who's self-actualized and self-aware, will put the square peg in the square hole. If they get the round peg, well, they'll find the biggest hammer they can, hammer through that square hole, move on to the next problem.
Yeah.
And the point was, people who are linchpins, people who are proactive, they're always vital inside of an organization. They're always relevant because they're always looking for that next problem to help solve. And when it comes to making safety, you're absolutely right. You can't wait for it to come from a leadership. And maybe, you know, maybe another discussion for another time is, should it even be coming from leadership? I'm a big fan of self-actualized teams. And I think that maybe they themselves should create their own, I hate to say safe space because there's negative connotations to that, but they should create their own safety and operate inside that model.
Yeah, I just got the whole millennial thing. Sorry, millennials out there. I just, you know, sorry, I'm a little older. No, you're right. I mean, so you do what you can at the team level, for sure, right? I do think it's top down, bottom up, grassroots is in there. And you should expect your leadership to provide these conditions. I'm just saying, don't wait for it to be handed to you.
Right. So, it's not going to be handed to you on a platter. You're going to have to grab it yourself.
Right. Right. So, I mean, you look at protecting reputation. Oh boy, I just went through all the online training, learning management system, ethics and risk and all those courses that you need to take every so often at your organization, if you're a big one, and our reputation's huge for us, right? And what can you do as an individual to protect that?
Right. It takes a lifetime to build a positive reputation, It can be destroyed in minutes.
Oh yeah. We look at, you know, when you're getting into, I mean, unless you're going to play, you know, we're technology people again, you and I, but this isn't all about technology, but I think about the sci-fi Battlestar Galactica. Why did this one ship survive the Cylon attack? Because they weren't part of the network. So that's one way to go. But most of us have to be part of the network these days. And the consequences and the reputation bang can be quite big. There's I won't name names. One of the big three credit bureaus got into trouble recently. Mm-hmm. And I can't even apply for credit with my own company, who is a bank today, because of it. And it's everybody's job to proactively make the environment safer.
Yep, I would concur. It's not a one-person thing. It's not a concept introduced by a manager somewhere. It's not a agile coach telling you need to be safe. It really is it's more of a cultural adoption almost,
right?
And it really is like a virus, in the sense that you introduce it to a couple of people, they help introduce it to the team. The team starts functioning. My example from before, I've had other people come up to me and say, how did you get these results out of this team? What are some of the things you did? What can I try and recreate with my team to get them to that point? And it does grow like a virus, because people are seeing, what's going on over there? Over there, they're delivering. And not only are they delivering, they don't look as stressed as I am. And they're not so worried about defects. What are they doing? And how do I get in that game? And that's a big thing. Just the internal, yeah, the internal rumor mill talking about, hey, we work over here and it's great.
How do you get unafraid to fall off the skyscraper, right? Or the Golden Gate Bridge? How do you get there? You know, and that's how we've been wrapping these. We're three down, one to go for the principles. We kind of usually wrap up with challenging our listeners to make their dent in these principles spreading. Have you given any thought to how we challenge our listeners to make safety a prerequisite?
I would say that if I was challenging everyone, my remark would be, find one interaction that you have between the time you hear this and a week, And this interaction, be it with a team, be it with a coworker, be it with a different resource in a different department, find a way to introduce the concept of it being safe for them to experiment and try and communicate openly. It could be something as getting a developer or a tester or someone on your program team, project team. Again, we're in technology, so I'm falling back on software references. Getting them to understand that it's okay to try something. You think it's a little crazy. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, okay, what do we learn from it? Well, let's not do that again, but let's take our learnings and apply that somewhere else. So I would challenge our listeners to say, find one person, one interaction that you have on a day-to-day basis, and try to introduce the concept of safety with them and get them to understand that, okay, I'm okay with speaking my mind, and I'm okay with trying, knowing that I may fail, as long as I learn from it.
Cool.
How about you, Paul? What would you suggest?
Yeah, so the thing for me is look for where people are making mistakes in your organization. I'll try not to be technical about it. Yeah, I'm an engineer. I'm probably born that way. But this isn't just engineering. This is whatever your accountability is in your organization. There are mistakes that occur, and there are consequences for those mistakes. Instead of continuing to deal with the consequences, what can you do to make those mistakes impossible to happen? Is there something you can do to change the system to make it impossible for that mistake to occur?
Awesome.
And just think about it. You don't have to solve it by yourself, by the way. Talk to teammates. Talk to teammates across team lines and just noodle it out. Rather than continue to live with the mistakes and chastise for the mistakes and, you know, you're in violation of policy XYZ. No.
Right.
No. How about we make the policy it's not possible to make this mistake anymore? So that's my challenge.
Perfect. Well, I think that just about puts us at time, Paul. So do you have anything you want to plug as we wrap this one up?
No, the only thing I'm selling is transforming the world of work. I do this because I like it. If you want to reach out to me personally, Paul_V_Elia, E-L-I-A. You'll find me more on LinkedIn, but I've linked the two together. I answer to both.
Awesome. And as for me, if anybody wants to contact me, you can always find me floating around the coalition. I've been banging out some blog posts lately. I have one coming up, not to tease it. It is we're going to talk about Agile, Entropy, and the Nuremberg Defense. I found a way to tie those three together. I enjoy the historical tie-in, so I hopefully right. that can generate some conversation. If you want to find me on Twitter, I can be found at @BackdoorAgile. Once again, Paul, thank you for your time. I want to thank our listeners. If you like us, please give us a shout out. Hop on the coalition and give us some feedback. If you like the podcast, like us on iTunes. It helps increase our visibility and get us higher in the rankings. And we appreciate your constant dedication and listening. Thank you again, Paul, for your time.
Hey, Jay, before we go,
shoot.
Joshua Karievsky is interested in doing a recap. So if you've been listening to this podcast or any of them in this series, and we'll do all four principles, and you've got questions, Let us know. Anything you want to ask Joshua, we're going to have him to answer those questions.
Perfect. That's a great call out.
Yeah, let's get those questions going. I think we may even send some communications out to the membership at the coalition, agileuprising.com. Come on out and check us out and let us know what you think.
How to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 U.S.-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's P-A-I-R.com.